Indeed.
Hi, good evening. I'm Tom Beebe. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm thrilled to be with you tonight. It's particularly pleasurable for me because my whole Alcoholics Anonymous life is represented in this room. There's a contingent over here from Pasadena that was there when I came in, and that's really touching. There's a gentleman here from a men's meeting that I first went to and sobered up with. A long life's path in this service. I also have my general service conference sponsor, Ann G, is here, is delighted to be in her territory. And one of my DCMs from my area in San Diego is here, and I'd like to introduce him. Gene, would you please stand up? Give him a welcome. Not too much happened in my life. Well, I was about 29 years old. I'd grown up down in the Pasadena area and had really wanted for nothing. And was gone to high school and went off to college and went to this college, and they had this great, wonderful orientation week, and everybody was having a great time. And Friday night, just like this, they were going to have a dance, and all these freshman ladies were all dressed up in their finest, and we were all in our finest, and we were going to go make a run on the freshman ladies. And all of a sudden the senior guys came in and just cut us out, and that was really disappointing. And but my roommate was from Illinois, and he had a fake ID, so we went to get some beer and kind of think this one over. And so we got a couple of six packs of Country Club malt liquor and went out and parked behind this building and started drinking the beer and throwing cans out the window. And we just had one little problem. We happened to be parked behind the the DMV building, and the cops came and they arrested us and took us to jail. So the first time I ever went out and consciously used alcohol to suppress pain, I'm in jail. Same thing happened 17 years later. I mean, it was just, I don't know why. I guess in today's age, with all our education and everything else, I should have gotten some tremendous information at that point. Well, you know, the information I got was very simple. Don't drink behind the DMV building. It's just an easy message for an alcoholic to pick up on. And I I didn't make it too good in college because I'd found beer, and it was a solution to my inadequacies. So I was encouraged to go into the Army, and I did that, and went over to Europe and came back and went back to college and got a little degree and married a lady, and we were living in an apartment, and then we got the first one was all furnished, and the next one we got was kind of unfurnished. We borrowed, you know, with little early attic furniture from everybody and so on. And about this time I'd made a couple of major career moves. I think I'd gone from about $400 a month to maybe $450 a month or something like that. And I was working with a small company, and they were in the dental business, and we went up to go to a convention in Las Vegas. I'm 29 years old. I've been looking for something all my life. Haven't found it yet. But I went up on this Friday to go up to this dental convention in Las Vegas. And I've never been to a hospitality suite, never had an expense account, never had any of those things. But all of a sudden, there I am. And we went up there on that Friday, and we set up this big, huge booth and got all organized, and I was the junior man, and they told me to go downtown and get a couple of cases of booze and bring it back and spread it around this room, and we'd get some mix and ice and stuff, and we called that a hospitality suite. And that made sense to me, and I went and did it. got it all set up, and it looked terrific. I said, what do I do now? And they said, well, you get all dressed up and get your exhibitor's badge on, and look sharp, go down the lobby of the Riviera, and if you see any dentists down there, you go tell them to come by our booth the next day. And I said, okay. And so I hot put it down to the lobby of the Riviera looking for dentists, and I looked all over for dentists, and I couldn't find any dentists. And I looked over in the bar, and I saw two ladies over there, and I thought maybe they were dentists. That was to start a long run. Hi, honey, how are you? Can I buy you a drink? You know, I do that, and I got pretty good at that, and I would buy these drinks and sign my name and leave tips so the bartender knew what my drink was, and we got going on, and we got through that convention in Vegas, and the company thought I was doing pretty good, so the following year in 65, they let me go on five more during that course of that year, and I was so good at getting so good at this that in 1966, they put me in charge of conventions. And I thought that was a great honor, and I thought what that meant was let's do more. And so we did. We went to 68 conventions in 52 weeks. There was not a whole lot of sobriety that year, I'll tell you. And early in the year of 67, they called me in and they told me they couldn't afford me. And I was really disappointed because I'd been putting out for these people. I'd been spending all this time away from my family, making all these personal sacrifices. Hadn't been able to watch the Dicondra grow. You know, I just thought I had really been put upon, but I went out and had a couple of drinks, thought it over, and I realized immediately what the problem was. This is a real small company. What I needed to do was go to work for a big company, big, huge company. They'd understand what I had to offer. So I went for this big, huge company. And things were going pretty good there at the big, huge company. But I had made a very critical mistake if you're alcoholic, like I was alcoholic, or I am alcoholic. I did not interview them, and I did not check out their work habits before I went to join their firm. I'm one of those that have been going in about 8:30, quarter 9, leaving about 11, having a few drinks, getting back from lunch about 2, doing some, I don't know, twiddling thumbs till 4, 4:30, going home. That's been what I was used to. Now I'm in a big company, and they're all organized, and they all have, like, early to work contests. You know, everybody gets there at 6:30, and they're standing out in front of their office, you know, waiting to see who the last dog is. And at the evening, it's the same way. They're all waiting to see, you know, who will be the last one to leave. Well, God, you know, finally, 6:30, quarter 7, you finally decide to lose, you know, and you go out. But one of the problems that was here is a mystery happened that I didn't even know that this was part of the social revolution at all. When noon would come, they'd reach down in their desk, and they'd pull out this bag. And lunch was in it, you know? And they'd sit there on that with that desktop lunch, you know, and maybe go get some 7-Up or something, you know, and stick it all back in the little desk and go right on working. Well, now you're a big shooter like I am. You know, that's not what you... I didn't even have a sack, much less a lunch pail or anything else. I didn't know what to do. Well, as you can imagine... You know, and I guess what I forgot to say also, my wife didn't know how to make lunch either, and if I was, it was either I make my lunch or I wasn't going to have lunch. And it got really grim early, maybe 10 days, 2 weeks into this, and my tolerance was not doing too well, and I slipped out. I feigned an excuse to go out, and I had a drink at lunch. And I started having a couple of drinks at lunch. And then I found out the timing was getting a little bad to get the car, get through the gate, get out, get back, and so on. There's a real easy solution. Take your booze to work with you. So I did that. I started hauling the booze to work. And that just kept me going for a long, long, long time. And so one day I was called in and advised that as part of company policy, you don't have liquor in your desk. I thought that was really short-sighted, but, you know... My planning just was starting to get really bad at this time. But they canned me for my drinking. And I went out and had a few drinks. And I was able to accept this. Because what I realized is I just overshot the mark a little bit. And if I went to work for a medium-sized company, things would be better. So I went to work for a medium-sized company. And you guessed it, a year later they canned me for my drinking. And then I went for another to work for another company, and they canned me for my drinking. And I went to work for another company, and they canned me for my drinking. And at the same time they did, my wife canned me for my drinking. And by this time, the state of California had caught up with me a couple of times, and I didn't have a driver's license, and times were tough. We're living down in Irvine, California. At that time, there was nothing but dirt in a couple of university buildings, a few tract houses. We were in one of them, or I was in one of them. And they didn't have any liquor stores in the area. And, you know, I've been coming, used to living in areas where they had liquor stores, including free delivery. Which is really, that was a great device. Whoever thought of that, you know. Two great things that somebody thought of along the way. One was free delivery, and the other one was open the bars at 6 a.m. I like both of those decisions. Anyway, I'm down in this place, and I have nowhere to go. You know, it's really difficult to get liquor because the walk to the closest store was going to be 5 or 6 miles. And so I did that once. And then I said, I got to solve this problem. I got to have transportation. So I went and got a bike. And I was to have a few adventures on my bike. One of which is I got the first drunk on bike arrest in the history of Orange County. And they took my bike away. No problem. I had a 3-speed Huffy. And I knew if I went and got a 10-speed Schwinn, I'd be back in control again. So I went off and got my 10-speed Schwinn and was on it a couple of weeks or whatever, and I crashed in a ditch, and the cops found me, and they carted me off to Orange County Medical Center and put me in the jail ward. And apparently some guy riding a bike, looking about like me on the same colored bike, had ripped off a liquor store of a pint or something along the way, and there was an all-points bulletin for this guy, and I can't possibly vision that I was any threat to anybody, but anyway, they did, and they carted me off and put me in this jail ward, and they tied me down. It was kind of a jail cycle ward. And I guess the part that I remember most is it's just like it was tonight. You know, there I am in leather restraint, absolutely tied down, can't move anything. Wake up maybe 3 or 4 days later, when I first come conscious at all, the only thought on my mind is, how do I get a drink here? You know, here I am, locked in this cycle, just tied down tight. And that was what I thought about. That was the only thing I thought about. How do I get a drink? Well, finally they lightened up on the restraint a little bit, and I was able to sneak out and attempt a couple of escapes from the place. I'm not too good at that. You know, you're walking down the hallway with your IV and your butt flapping in the breeze, and it's... you're noticeable. They gave me an opportunity to... they thought I had a problem with alcohol, and I was willing to go along with anything just to get out of there, so I said, sure. And I went, they sent me to Metropolitan State Hospital, Norwalk. That was, they have a few adventures there. If you haven't been to Norwalk, I don't know what it is. I guess Camarillo's close by up here, but Norwalk, that first week, you're confined to the ward. And that was an interesting thing. If when you arrived there at Metropolitan State Hospital, Norwalk, they had a guide, you know, like your guide that was going to show you around the place, show you the ropes of the deal and everything else. And he takes you in and shows you where your locker is. And when I was going in there, he said, can I see your shaving kit? And I said, sure, here. And seconds later, I looked around, and he popped the top of my aftershave and was just down in it like that. I didn't know aftershave was 17 proof, you know. Small things I was starting to learn about life. And I was to stay there for a week, and the second week you're allowed to kind of go on campus to start, and the third week the disability income check comes, and then you're given an opportunity to take a check and go down to a JCPenney's, a Thrifty, or someplace and buy your personal needs, you know, some underwear and socks and T-shirts and whatever. And so I'm walking on down to Thrifty, and one of these buddies of mine, my new friends, you guys all been there too, huh? And I'm going down the street with these new friends, and they, you know, come to the light, and I push the light, and I'm headed over to the Thrifty, and said, no, come on with me. And so down Norwalk Boulevard, under the bridge we go, and there's Casa Madrid. And we went in there and had a few drinks, you know, just to kind of get the day started. And we just kind of sit there and shoot pool and do whatever we did, and we go back and back to the ward at night and take a pill and have dinner, play bingo, you know, get up, go to group in the morning, you know, back down to the Casa Madrid. And we started doing that cycle, and then one day we're down there at the, ready to push the light bulb, either to go over to Casa Madrid or go over to Thrifty, and the bus came by. And somebody said, let's go to L.A. Why not, you know? God. So we jumped on the bus and bammo, you're in L.A., right in the heart of Skid Row. I don't know who did it, but when they laid out the whole transportation system of Los Angeles, the heart and core of that transportation system is Skid Row. You get on any bus in L.A., and it will finally end in Skid Row. I don't know why they did that. But anyway, I got down there, and they were... And you get down there with your buddies, and you have a few drinks, and check the action out. And you go back up, you know, go back to Norwalk, and you're feeling pretty heady because you've had been out, you know, on the town. And you, we started going down there pretty regular, and we were down there one Friday night, and of course it was Friday night, and we were all in our best. Somebody said, why don't we stay over? Sounded like a good day to me. So we all pitched in. We got a room, and we're now spending Friday night in Skid Row, you know. And that was going on for a while, and then all of a sudden one night, somebody said, why don't we stay down for the weekend? And we did. And then all of a sudden, we didn't go back to the hospital anymore. And that's how I got to Skid Row. I didn't plan it that way. I just got there. And even at 50 cents a drink, you know, pretty soon you start to run out of the money, and we were splitting up, and we were all five or six of us, or how many ever many of us was, we were living in this little flop bed place, you know, this hotel was gouging us for, maybe we're paying $6-$8 a night, I don't know what it was. Anyway, and finally we don't have, you know, there's a big decision in life. Do I take my money and do I find myself shelter, or do I buy booze? And if any of you know, it's a real easy decision. Booze wins all the time. So now you're out on the street, and now you learn what street people do. And you learn things like how to sleep in a doorway by just leaning back. And you wake up one morning a few weeks later after being down there, and you're... wake up and consciously you're feeling kind of bad and things aren't going your way, and you see if I'm ever like that guy lying on the sidewalk, I'm going to have to do something about my drinking. A couple of weeks later you're lying on the sidewalk, in my case, and you make another pledge and commitment that if you're ever like the guy in the gutter there, you're going to have to do something about your drinking. One morning, I'm in the gutter, looking at the other guy, and the most amazing thing was that my mind accommodated, it was all right to be in the gutter. My mind had just, as I had chosen to sleep in the doorway, sit and lie on the walkway and lie in the gutter, my mind said, "Tom, it's okay." And I just went right down the toilet, and my mind said, "It's okay." I was just compromising myself. It was just nothing was going on. And life got so bad, and after being in the hospital and being in the jail, and that's all part of what happens down at Skid Row, and it gets a little threatening to your own survival down there. And one of the guys suggested I go up to Pasadena and get out of there, and I jumped the train and went up to Pasadena, and I got up there, and that's in the heart of another Skid Row area and up in Fair Oaks in Pasadena, and I was up there, and I don't know what happened. Life just got worse. And I had, my mother was involved in my life at this time and trying to help me out, and she had some really good-minded friends. And an incident had come that she, while I had been down there and I'd come back off Skid Row, there was a little moment of clarity along the way in one of those incidents, and before I got down there and I'd had a chance to go back over to, I was going to become an international salesman, and I got over to a university in Arizona, and they were going to make me an international salesman, and I didn't make it there, and I come home to spend Easter week with my mom, and we were all sitting around. I'd been playing hide the bottle with her all week, and Sunday afternoon about 2, you know, we're sitting in there, and she's being nice, and I'm talking nice, and we're looking at each other, we're kind of smiling, and all of a sudden, and here comes the nice man from AA. Now, I don't know how it is for you, but when I've been drinking all night Friday, all night Saturday, and Sunday afternoon, I'm not too feeling good, and here's the nice AA man. And the nice AA man asked me if I wanted, you know, told me his story and said, did I want what he have, and I didn't. And I was too. I spent some time turning around the town again, doing some more drinking. Finally, I got back to Skid Row, and things weren't working out for me, and I knew I was going to have to go to jail one night, and I found a dime someplace, and I called this guy and told him, yes, I'd do whatever he told me to do, and he took me to this men's recovery home, and I went to that men's recovery home, but I went there physically. I was never there emotionally. It was just another place to stop. I was just another flop for me, and I just didn't pick up on AA. They took me to some meetings there, but I was never there. I was never there because in the book they tell us, and then they read a portion of chapter 3, there's a little thing in there that says that you can either write about face and drink like a gentleman, or hats are off to you. And when I went to my first meeting, that's what I heard. And that's what kept me out there. You know, I didn't hear anything else. That satisfied me. And I just, with all my bravado, with all my ego, with everything else, I decided, by God, I'm going to be the one. And that made sense to me. And I went out there and I damn near died trying to prove to all of you, you know, that I was not an alcoholic. Anyway, things didn't go too good in this home, and one night I was back down in Fair Oaks Boulevard there, and all I know is something must have gone wrong, and I must have done one of my usual pranks or whatever, and the police were coming down an alley, and they looked over, and they happened to look over by some trash cans and a whole bunch of pile over there, and there were 2 feet sticking out from under all the newspapers that were piled up by the trash cans, and they came over and kicked the feet, and it was me, and I was apparently still alive, and they took me down to the hospital and put 57 stitches in my face, taped me up, and sent me on my way. And I walked out of that hospital that night, and I looked up and said, God, help me stop drinking. And that date was August 11th of 71, and it's not been necessary for me to take a drink then, and I'm real grateful for that. I'm real grateful for that. But sobriety did not come easy to me. And that's the part I really want to share most about is my recovery and what happened to me through that and into service. That first 60, 90 days I was to go through some experience that most of you have probably gone to, and it's just part of life, at least part of recovery as I knew it then. It took me about, ultimately, 120 days to dry out. Somewhere along the time, I told you, I that night was in early August, and some events started to happen in December that started to send me on down the road. One of the events was that I woke up one morning and I looked all around the room and something was different. It was not like God had been in the room, but something was different in the room. and I finally realized what it was. And for me, I'd always had a yellow stain spot in the middle of my pillow from alcohol. And I woke up this morning and the stain was gone. And I finally had dried out. So if you're sitting here tonight, you got sweaty palms, you only got 60, 90 days or whatever like that, there's somebody else that had sweaty palms for 120 days, so don't let it bother you. Another thing happened, I was living in a corner room at the fourth floor of the Y across from the police helicopter, which kept me up most of the night. And I was living in a room that did not have a water basin, so I had to go down and use the community john. And every morning I'd get my little instant coffee that I'd stolen in my cup, and I'd go down to this, make myself a lukewarm tap water coffee, bring it back to my room, and sit down and have it. And right around Christmas time, at that time, another event happened. They transferred me to a room on the second floor that had a wash basin. And I can't share with you the gratitude I felt that first morning when I could get up and make my lukewarm tap water coffee in my own room and never leave it. And just to sit there and just feel a little tiny bit of restoration of life and peace. Just a little tiny bit. And that happened. But what really another thing that happened along that way is that some of these guys who've been sponsoring me, looking out for me, on Christmas Eve, you know, I was going to see my mom on Christmas Day, and they took me out and bought me a whole set of clothes. They just went out and completely outfitted me, so I had a good-looking set of threads to be on to go see my mom for Christmas Day. And to me, that's the greatest, one of the great things that Alcoholics Anonymous did for me, that they clothed me on my first Christmas that I was drying out to go see my mother. And that really impressed me that a whole bunch of people would even think about doing something like that. They even cared to do something like about that. That just really surprised me. And so they did that, and I had my little holiday outfit, and I wore that proudly every night, you know, and things were going good. All this time that was going on, I was going to meetings. I'd start going to meetings at the infamous 202 Club there in Pasadena, and finally I'd start going to some other meetings. And they told me where the meetings were, and they handed me a schedule, and they said the meetings are down over here, and I can't relate it too much to this town, but I would walk to 3 or 4 miles to get to a meeting, because they told me if you're willing to go to any lengths to get this program, you'll do stuff like that. I didn't have anybody that was willing to come by and pick me up and car me off to a meeting. They just told me, "Well, see you tomorrow night." And I said, "Well, why don't you pick me up?" And they said, "Well, see you tomorrow night." And that was the way that was. And I started going, and I'd walk to these meetings. I'd leave 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd get to these meetings okay. And I thought, gee whiz, you know, after a couple of months of this, these AA people, if somebody would come up to me and say, "How would you like a ride home?" Nobody did that to me. And I'm really glad they didn't. Finally, one night, in the pouring, drenching rain, and a guy, I was out at the furthest outpost, remotest meeting, a guy said, "Could I give you a lift home?" And he did. And I loved him for it, because I didn't have to walk home in the rain that night. And it made me feel good, and I don't know what triggered it, but other people started giving me rides to meetings. And that made me feel real good. We got through that holiday season, got into the start of the year, first part of the year, and I was introduced to group service. My sponsor came up to me and told me that my job was to... I was going to be chairman of the Sunday morning speakers meeting in South Pasadena, and I was going to be chairman of their coffee detail. And boy, that sounded great to me. You know, it sounded impressive and hopeful, and I'd had all that hospitality experience, you know. So I started working on this, and I had an assistant. He's here tonight. We got sober together. His name is Hans. And we started... doing this coffee detail. I'll tell you how I remember, because it was going to be a total goal. We got out there, and we got what it is was you had to get this building at 8 o'clock in the morning and turn on these big huge commercial ovens urns and get those going. And once those were fired up and running, you go across the street to Winston's, get 144 donuts, come back, split them in half, put them on the table. About the time you had them split in half, put them on the table, turn around, the coffee was ready to be made. You make the coffee, you do all this. You'd be all set up about 10:15 in the morning, and about 10:17, the first customer would come. And they'd come into that meeting, and they'd come walking into that meeting, and they'd come into you, and you thought you had eye contact, but you really didn't have eye contact, and they're shining you on with "Hi, good morning," but their eyes are looking down, and they're looking at that table for their donut. and they come in there, and maybe they're looking for a chocolate one with little coconut things on top. And, you know, they go down and they say, "Hi, how are you? How are you?" And then they grab that donut. And the next one coming in goes in, and they come into that meeting. They go down and they come look at the table. Maybe he wants a Long John, you know, with cinnamon on top. So he goes over, and as soon as he finds that Long John with cinnamon on top, he smiles. God, his day's made, you know. And these people start, they come in, and they're all looking for that. And I equated the reason, you know, happiness was having your own donut. It was going on, and God, I was doing it, and I was getting organized this committee, and we had money to spend, and I was going out, and we had, on Valentine's Day, you know, we had all the little heart stuff hanging down, and red, white, and blue, and red and white, and all that stuff, and little things on the donuts, and we got up the 4th of July, and I wanted to get them to be red, white, and blue, you know, I wanted everything color-coordinated and everything else. We got up to Halloween, and God, Halloween was just wild, and we got through that whole thing, and this was just a generating experience. And I knew very shortly somebody was going to come up to me and tell me that I'd been nominated to be the State of California Coffee Detail Chairman for Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I was to have my first lesson in humility. I was about 11 months or 12 months in this program now, and I was starting to feel a little frisky, and decided that I ought to be getting socially active and going to a few dances and things. And so I went up to my sponsor and I said, "Sponsor, I want to give you 30 days notice. Because I thought I knew it would take him a couple of weeks to interview candidates to replace me and a couple of weeks for me to train them, you know. 30 days seemed reasonable to me." I told that to him before the meeting started. 17 minutes later at the coffee break, he said, "Tom, you've been replaced." And that hurt. You know, I didn't know what was going on. But what I need to also tell you is while all this was going on for that first 12, 13, 14, 15 months, I had never admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I had gone along, and they told me, "Fake it till you make it." I was faking it as best I could, but I was unable to admit to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. My pride and ego damn near killed me. And I was out there, and I would go to the meetings, and I'd talk about all the steps, and I'd talk about this, and I could discuss things, and I was expert on everything, and had the book half memorized like everybody else, and going on and doing all that stuff, but I had never admitted to my innermost self. And so that first birthday, I had went and had seven, typically had 7, 8, 9, 10 birthday cakes, and a lot of pats on the back, and everything was great, and so on and so forth. And I just rolled on into that second year. And the final event that had happened during that first year was about 9 months into this, my sponsor told me that I needed to get a job. Why? Well, he told me I had to put some money back in the basket. I didn't understand that. You see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when they passed the seventh tradition, they used to say, "If you need some, take some." And I used to take some. Sometimes a lot. They don't do that anymore. That's probably why we're having all the focus on the seventh tradition.
I don't know.
Anyway, I'd take some, and he told me I needed to put money back in there and pay my way in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to get a job, and I finally found a company that would hire me, and they gave me this employment application, and it's typical employment application, you know, your name, age, address, stuff, are you a veteran, yes or no. Then the next thing that comes up is work history. Tell us everything you've done in the last 5 years. Boy, that's tough. You can't put down you've been self-employed. He came to grips with it that I had to put it all down, everything had gone on in the last 5 years. And I knew it was just a joke, and I was kind of thought I'd just go along and with my sponsor and be nice to him. And we would do this, and he'd be pleased with me that I had filled out the application, and we had submitted it, and even though we knew we were going to be turned down, we had gone through the exercises, and I had pleased him by doing this. Well, he told me that the reason I put everything down there and all that bad stuff on that first application is because that company ever hires me, I'm never going to have to explain that stuff to anybody else ever again. And I'm here to tell you in my own case that I put everything down on that application. I turned it in. They hired me. And I've never had to explain that past to anybody ever again at the level of employment. They told me another reason I should do that was because a lot of people that don't do that lie in wait because sometimes on a hot afternoon in August, they're sitting in their office and they get a phone call about 4 o'clock to come to the personnel department and the little brain triggers up. I wonder if they found out I'm an alcoholic. So I wanted to share my experience if you're out getting a job and so on and they pretty well, maybe you want to put down the truth. I didn't believe it would work, but, you know, what do I know about his plan? It just was amazing to me that I could get a job anyway, and this job was great. And I loved it, and I'm still in that industry that hired me, and it's been very good to me. But anyway, so now I had a job, and I'm going on to the second year, and I'm just working my little fanning off and trying to, I'm now out in a little one-bedroom apartment, and things are going along pretty good in life. And I get up to that second birthday, and an event happens to me that I personally believe happens to every alcoholic that I've come directly in contact and had personal contact with. There comes a time in our sobriety where life comes up zeros, one more pile comes in, and the brain says, I know the solution, take a drink. And you have no defense against the drink. Mine came right at my second-year birthday. I was out on a hot August afternoon. I was out in San Bernardino. I was selling this guy some insurance. I was going to cut his insurance premiums in half. He decided to stay with his brother-in-law. I was a little irritated. I was heading back to Pasadena down Foothill Boulevard. There's a great watering hole there, the Sycamore Inn. And I started getting invitations to come in the Sycamore Inn. And I would say, it said Sycamore Inn 5 miles ahead on the right, you know. Sycamore Inn 3 miles ahead on the right. And I was starting to salivate. I could start tasting the gin. And then it was 1 mile ahead on the right, 500 feet ahead on the right. And finally it said, turn right. And a car went straight ahead. It was at that moment that I admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. 2 years, 700 and some odd meetings in a row. So if you're struggling with that, know somebody else has struggled with that. And then the guy decided that I had been such a hard learner on that one, I probably needed to be placed in a spiritual environment to learn anything about spirituality and any concept of God. And these guys took me out to a retreat house twice a year for the next 3 years to Manresa, a Jesuit retreat house. And I was to go out there and finally on a Sunday morning after being out there, going out there twice a year for 3 years, a moment of clarity came for me and I fell in a priest's arms and discovered God as I know Him today. And that's been a great, great blessing for me. But please remember, that's 5 years into Alcoholics Anonymous, step three for me. Become really willing. 3 years. Plus 2 years, 5 years into this program. So it just did not come easy for me. But along the way, I had some other things have been going on, besides my futile attempt at the steps. I've been introduced to General Service, and I became a GSR. At a couple of meetings, and I've been moving. I was not untypical alcoholic. I was highly migratory, and I had a chance to become a district GSR, and I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the privilege of being able to represent the group. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand anything about it, but I was a GSR, and that was part of my life. And I would go to the meeting and I'd come back and sometimes the group would let me report. Most of the time they wouldn't. You know? You know how that is? At least down our way, most of the times our GSRs get up to go to give up their reports and it's always about that last 20 seconds of the meeting, somewhere between getting up and holding hands to say the Lord's Prayer. In that little interval, we'll have the GSR report. Things are changing a little bit. But anyway, I got involved with service at that time. And that was just kind of continued to go on, and I would continue because there were meetings that needed to have representatives, and I always was kind of one to volunteer. and raised my hand, and somebody told me when I got here real early that you should never say no to an AA request. So if somebody came up to me and said, "You're the GSR," okay. And that's how it worked for me, and that's how I became a GSR and got involved with service. But my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years into it, I've now done 3 steps, and I had to really get into doing inventory. That was not too difficult for me to do the inventory. It was not too It was not too difficult to share that with somebody. That was not a real... I think I was painstaking in that process, but I was quick in the process, as the book suggests. And I was, and I got that done, and I became willing to have God remove my defects of character. And I was racing on in, and I was up on the eighth step, and I had my list of amends and was starting to make some amends and thought I was doing pretty good at making amends. And there were a couple of employers that I tried to make amends to, and they didn't want to hear me. They didn't want to see me. It was just amazing. You know, I thought the great one, that little part, except when it injures them, would, that we might hurt somebody else by showing up to make an amend, never dawned on me that was a reality. I didn't know the sensitivity of that until I attempted to get a hold of some old employers who I knew I had injured these guys' careers or had not been beneficial, at least in my vision. And I would call them and I'd work all these conniving ways to get in their presence. And they absolutely rejected me at every doorstep. So I did what I was told to do, was to write out that amend and throw in the God box, and that worked for me. And I was really... But I didn't really understand that when I started it, and I certainly understand it today. There's some people that, unfortunately, there's some people in this world that just don't want to see Tom Beebe again. And that was hard to accept then. It's easy now. Then I moved down to Orange County, and was sitting in a room one night, and I saw a guy who looked like a sponsor, and he talked a little bit like his story and mine were the same, and I went over to be his... asking to be my sponsor, and he said yes, fine, and that was okay. And we went out for coffee, and I told him the story of just about what I told you right up to now. And he said, "Well, what have you done about all that stuff you stole?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you have to make financial restitution to all these people." And I said, "You got to be kidding me." And he said, "No, that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Well, can't you say you're sorry?" And so he introduced me to the how we make financial amends. The hardest thing for me to tell you tonight is that here standing right in front of you is a common petty thief. I would have chosen any goal in life, maybe even to be an alcoholic, but I never chose the goal to be a common petty thief. And I had to come face to face with the fact that I was a common petty thief. And he said, "We're going to sit down and we're going to try and figure out how much stuff you stole, and then we're going to develop enough money, a pool of money, and we're going to get some cashier's checks done, and you're going to go take this into these places and hand it to these people and tell them that you need to do this to continue in your sobriety. You need to make financial amends to these people." And I said, "Okay." So we got this, we figured out, and I owed people like Thrifty, we'll say, we owed Thrifty $138. And we got the money together and put it in a cashier's check, and I was supposed to go in there and see the manager and tell him who I was and tell him that I was here to make financial amends, and would he please accept this check? Now, if you're any alcoholic, you know, that's just... nobody's going to buy into that. But to please my sponsor, I went and got the check, and I went into Thrifty and asked to see the manager. And the manager came out, and I told him, "I'm Tom Beebe. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to... could I have a minute of his time?" And I took it, and we went into his office, and I said, "I'm here, and I need to make financial restitution for all the things I stole while I was out in the street." And I handed him his check for $138. And he took it. And I said... I don't know where in management training they tell them that some dummy from AA is going to show up and he's going to want to hand you some money. You know? Getting through those financial amends was really difficult. Because every one of those, as long as it went on, and it went on for a couple, 3 years, I had to, during that period of time, I had to admit every time I did it that I was making that amend because I was a thief. And that really bothered me, personally. But that worked itself out pretty quick. And I'm now 8 years into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm into these financial amends, and things are going pretty good. And I did get those financial amends cleaned up pretty quick. And I happened to do that on just one of those mysterious evenings that I was in a step study meeting, and they were on chapter 9, and somebody was reading the promises, and all of a sudden all that black print came jumping off the page at me, and the idea of comprehending serenity and no peace, the idea that you could maybe make an intelligent decision, the concept of freedom from financial insecurity, all of those things that started to, my gosh, maybe this is all possible. You know, it's just incredible to me that short little trip from page 63 to 77 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous got us through all that spiritual stuff, and how quickly we got into the amends, and I was able to do that, and right there in the early 80s is these promises. That very, very short 20 pages in that book is just an incredible experience if we live it, at least as I've lived it for me. Just been a wonderful, wonderful thing to happen. Anyway, I was doing all that and experiencing all that, and then I got involved with service again, and I was living in another community, and they got me in to be a GSR, and then I became a very short-lived DCM, and kind of relocated down to San Diego, and down there I started getting into service, and I don't know what had been happening about the steps. The steps just seemed to go on for me. The steps just seemed to happen. Probably because I continued to go to retreat, probably because I continued to pray, probably because I continued to go to meetings. I don't know what it was. But the whole thing by osmosis, eventually I got into the comprehension of that 12th step, of having a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps, and that step part was going. But what then was started into my life, that's carried my life for the last 7 years, has been service. Because I went down to San Diego, and I had made one major decision before I went to San Diego, and I'd made it early in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was not going to ever go into a jail again, ever, for any reason, on any condition, much less as part of a silly H&I group. I just was not going to do that. And I went down there, and I found this men's meeting to be my home group, and this old geezer was sitting there, and I knew I could probably con him a little bit. He looked a little sleepy sometimes, and I thought I'd ask him to be my sponsor, and he said, that'll be just fine, I'll accept that. Are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, yes. He said, fine, you're going into main jail Monday. And that introduced me to the service structure, and the hospital, the H&I committee. I learned how that worked in with the area assembly, but I was still very confused at that time between our inner group and our general service structure, so I just kind of let all that hang out. And anyway, I got involved with our H&I committee, and I started doing that and became involved with it at a reasonably good level, like anybody does, which means you go once a week or once a month or whatever your panel is, and you do that. And I found that to be a great way to share the message. I would like to hope that I've always been able to do that when I was in there, and that very loving experience of H&I, that I was able most of the time to carry the message and not carry the disease. But you never know on those things. I just like to think I did. But it got me involved with the service structure, and all of a sudden I was going along, and I'd been involved with H&I for another couple of years, and then all of a sudden my sponsor told me that I was going to be the GSR from a group. From that Thursday night, Claremont Thursday night men's in San Diego, and he said, you're the GSR, go to the meeting. And I went to the meeting, and I'd been going to those meetings for a couple of months, and all of a sudden I missed it 1 month, came back the next month, found out I was a DCM. You know, they always have elections when you're gone. And that's how I got to be a DCM and start into the service structure. And I was to be involved with the service structure down there as a district committee member in San Diego. And I can't tell you what a pleasure that service responsibility gave me then, because it put me in touch at the level when I had just been a GSR, I had not really understood what it was. I was just going sitting in here and representing these meetings, but then all of a sudden I was a DCM, and I had to look at the evidence that was standing in front of me, which was we had 50-60 groups in our district, and we only had 10-12 GSRs coming, and I thought 10 or 12 GSRs was terrific. And then I became a DCM, and I realized, Jesus, you know, this is terrible. You know, we got to do something about that. So I started to go on the stump, you know, going out and threatening people to be GSRs and going into women's meetings and telling them they didn't belong in AA unless they gave me the name of GSR and doing all this other stuff, you know. Oh, I got demanding on that. And we finally got two or three more, you know, and the two or three more, and two or three more, and it just didn't come easy. And then, but I found developing that that district gave me a real feeling for family in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really, really, really behold to that idea that we, you know, I can't, we can. And the idea that we could get in that familial attitude with all the meetings who were part of the district made me feel real wonderful. And that district got going, and then finally some other things were coming along, and I got a chance to go into be available to serve in the general service structure at a level that I never anticipated. And one day, Sunday, almost 2 years ago, my name came out of the hat to be the delegate to represent the San Diego Imperial Area Assembly. And it was there I had the wonderful opportunity to meet Ann. But I need to tell you that in its own case, one of the things this whole service trail did that I never really experienced was I've learned the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel being here at the district meeting tonight of the 22nd district that I need to share a little of my feelings about how services work for me in my life. And I think it's without the service commitment in my life today, I think I would be far less person than I am today, whatever that is. I just don't know. I do know that service needs to be a major priority in my life to maintain my sobriety. And I found out that, and what I found out as I've been going along, I've been reading these pamphlets, and I've been reading the service manual, and I've been looking at all these things and so on, and nothing made any sense, you know, and there seemed to be these old fogies, and they had all the answers, and they'd talk to Bill, you know, and God, anything that used to cut me off worse is have some old dude come up to me and raise his hand and say, you know,
when I was talking to Bill,
and I thought, God, who was this guy, and so on, and so I started learning the history about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started learning about it as good as I can about the history just for myself so that I could be as good a representative of Alcoholics Anonymous as I possibly could. And I never had, I was never going to have an opportunity to go to New York to represent anybody for anything. But I knew one thing, I was going to be able to stand at my meeting and at least know the difference between what was right and what was wrong and what the traditions were and what our experience was. Because I've been told that all we do is share our experience and keep that going. And I knew that there were a lot of things infecting us, and I didn't know what about them, and I didn't know how it fit in. And I knew that when I got involved with service, was back there, really heavily involved with service, was 6-7 years ago, and we were having a tremendous problem with the addict alcoholic thing. And that was major, major discussion, and it was riveting through our organization, and people were forming their own groups, and they were calling themselves many, many different names, and AA was being ripped asunder over whether or not we would accept addicts into our AA meetings and so on and so forth. And I got involved in that controversy because I've never, you're talking to a pure alcoholic. I've never, you know, ingested any other thing. I've never took pills, never spoke that funny stuff, don't know anything about it, don't even know what you call it. By any, you know, local trade names, didn't know anything about it. But now I'm sitting there on my righteous pillar talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, by God, this is what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, and these are the pamphlets say, and everything says, you know, and we shouldn't do this stuff. And so the other guys over there were saying that addicts were okay, and Bill said it was okay, and he was an addict, and everybody can come in the meetings over here, and some other group is going over here, and by this time the women were forming meetings, the gays were forming meetings, and no smoking meetings appeared, and God, it was just going on and on and on and on. And I was wondering, you know, what about just going to an AA meeting, you know? Wouldn't it be nice just to go to an AA meeting? And I started putting all this stuff together, and I was ultimately chosen to, my name came out of the hat, and God sent me to represent San Diego at the General Service Conference. And one of the great things about it is that that opportunity is given to this individual is that it gave me an opportunity to find out whether I really knew anything about AA and our history or not. It gave me a chance, it's given you a chance on a continuing basis to review our history. It gives you a total reality that the guy that or lady that's coming in to represent North Dakota is just as good as the lady from or gentleman from Los Angeles. It doesn't matter where we're from. They stand in that conference just as individuals, and I had a great lesson in that. As a delegate a year ago, I was had an opportunity to present a bid for San Diego to host the 1990 International Convention, and we were unsuccessful. And the gentleman that had chaired that committee, the gentleman by his first name is Dan, I didn't like him too good because he chaired this committee and we'd all worked our britches off to have that thing come down to San Diego and we were kind of pretty well rejected out of hand and we had a few technical problems with our bid. We didn't have a convention center, but I mean, forget that. But this guy had chaired this committee and I felt that he was a personal vendetta and he'd been picking on us and he'd chosen this and I thought, who is this son of a bitch that we could make such a decision like this? And he was a trustee of Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't he understand where we were and he was probably some lofty attorney or a judge of something and he did something like this and had a great career going and was just totally detached from Alcoholics Anonymous and he was making a decision and how could he comprehend where I was coming from and anything else and after the conference was over. I was in the airport, and I just couldn't resist it. So I walked up to Dan, and I said, Dan, what do you do? And Dan said, I'm a maintenance manager at the Quaker Oats plant in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Oh. Took me all that time to get to that point to realize that has money, property, and prestige have nothing to do with service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was something that I had to have reinforced in myself. I have to tell you with great humility, I did that. But one of the things that's been amazing and wonderful for me is to see this fellowship respond to the challenge that is in front of us as we enter the second 50 years without that treasured copyright to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the idea that we could all start out again all over the second 50 years without some of those treasures available to us and that we as a fellowship could just be in God's light and go on was truly a wonderful opportunity for me. To be at that conference with Ann, to be at that conference with all the other delegates, to be at the conference that was involved with making a decision about bringing up the new small soft cover edition of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was wonderful. But the great thing, part of that conference for me, too, was the idea that I had an opportunity to participate in the sharing of financial responsibility. Our area down in San Diego has been financially responsible and directly supported and self-supported through by the groups only for several years, and they've been successful. And the idea that we in Alcoholics Anonymous have a need to be self-supporting at all levels. Because if we're self-supporting and independent on any outside revenue, including profits from sale of literature and so on, we can be holding absolutely to ourselves. That's how I feel about it. I feel very strongly about our financial freedom, because it seems whenever we give up that financial freedom, some other drummer is going to be making the beat to that, and we're going to march to somebody else. And I'm convinced that we don't want to do that. And we never have. We have a long tradition of never doing that at a time that we needed to wake up. And I was glad to be just around, you know, when that movement started. And Ann was chairing the finance committee that led us down that road. And I was really happy to be at that part of that whole turn that has happened in that area. Another thing that came up for me that I realized in my little responsibility in service is that it seemed to be, at least in our area, and it seemed to be happening a lot in my personal life, maybe because of delegates and I was getting phone calls, but we seemed to have a lot of groups that were trying to ally themselves with us. ACA in particular has made a strong rush recently, CA and NA and so on. Some groups are not clear about what their message is. You know, we do have some traditions. You know, my purpose and the group's purpose are the same purpose. and that's to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And the group's purpose, the group traditions tell us that that group should carry its message, whatever its message is for that group. And of course, every group runs autonomous, and there are no standards, no rules, and thank God for that. But it's really important for me to recognize that that other groups were coming in and they were working as part of that. And it and now, of course, the conference this year had an opportunity and gave a statement, which I'm pretty sure most of you are familiar with, which kind of, it started last year. And maybe it started 20 years ago. Maybe it started 50 years ago when Bill and Bob were together someplace. I don't know. But what it came to and the conclusion it came to was that it doesn't matter who's in this room tonight and what your many, many, many diseases are, but while you're here, let's just talk about alcoholism. And just try and refocus a lot of our efforts on just our singleness of purpose and let the others do whatever they want. I feel strongly that that's our heritage. I feel strongly that that is our great heritage, is our singleness of purpose. I feel absolutely spellbound at the fact that when Bill wrote the book that he said that at the end that no human power, you know, could have relieved my alcoholism, that I was hopeless and I was sick, but that God could and would have sought. That journey for me in seeking God is a daily one, and it's a loving one, and I wish it for you. Thank you.